Hello, and welcome to Women with Issues. If you are a regular listener, you know by now what we're all about. But if you're a brand new listener, rest assured we are not talking about our issues. No, no. I'm not saying Tracy and I don't have issues. Have some. That's another podcast. I'm just saying we're not talking about them here. So here we're talking about policy issues that matter to women, and in particular lately with regard to the current election cycle, with regard to women over 50 and the issues of most importance to us. I'm Diane Kilivris, your host, along with my co-host and potting partner, still socially distanced. I miss you.
Miss you too.
The lovely and smart Tracy Maxwell Hurd.
Hello, everyone.
We're pretty excited about our podcast today because we landed a great guest. Her name is Professor Tracy Thomas, and she's going to talk to us about that new Supreme Court appointment, Amy Coney Barrett, and the implications and impacts that appointment could have on a whole lot of things, from court packing to Roe v. Wade to the Affordable Care Act, LGBTQ rights, all the stuff everyone's talking about. And hopefully we'll get our listeners' questions answered as well. But first, Tracy Hurd, I just wanted to say, it won't be long now till we know just how much impact the women over 50 vote had on this presidential election anyway, once we start analyzing those exit polls and those mail-in votes and all of those early voting ballots. And we'll just see if women over 50 really did make the difference as predicted in the AARP Harris poll, you know, to see, did we really carry this election?
Maybe. Voting's pretty high. You know, what, 257 million people are eligible to vote? Well, no, I'm sorry, 240 of 257 are eligible to vote in the U.S. We've had something like 85 million that have voted, or they're projecting could vote before November 3rd, and 150 million in total. So Wow. That's like huge. That's like 62%. If we hit that number, pretty unprecedented. Those are insane. And 62%, really, in my opinion, is not great. But it's a whole lot better than we normally do. So
yeah,
very engaged. Yeah. This cycle.
People are engaged. So the election isn't the only news. On October 26th, like 1 week and 1 day before the presidential election, the new Supreme Court justice was confirmed, a conservative, Amy Coney Barrett. And I'd like to introduce our guest. Her name is Professor Tracy Thomas. She's the Cyberling Chair of Constitutional Law and the Director of the Center for Constitutional Law at the University of Akron. She is also the author of several books, including Feminist Legal History, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and the Feminist Foundations of Family Law, and Women and the Law. Professor Thomas, welcome.
Welcome. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, let's jump right into it here and start talking about the reason that we actually invited you and your expertise to join us here today, to kind of get some perspective on what the Supreme Court might consider, how they might go about those considerations, what things they might be looking at. You know, lots of people are talking about big changes and decisions that have already been made being reconsidered in light of the court now being so extremely conservative. So do you think that's possible? I guess that's my first question. Do you think there really will be some considerations or reconsiderations of things like the ACA, Obamacare, that's already in the courts right now, you know, LGBTQIA rights, civil rights protections, Roe v. Wade, you know, and I've got 25, I could go on and on. But, you know, of the top things that rights that we have gained over the last 50 years, how do you think that might look?
I mean, I think the answer is absolutely all of those things are going to change. Okay. I mean, that's what happens when you have a 6-3 split on the Supreme Court. They have a clear conservative majority. And even if one of the conservative justices aligns with the liberals on various issues, and in each of them have, you know, some subjects that are Gorsuch, we saw with textualism and some criminal procedure rights. But even if one switches, that's not going to be enough. You're still going to have your conservative majority. And so, I mean, that was the long game here for the 2016 election, was to have a conservative majority and really insulate those kinds of decisions. And so I think we are going to get a reconsideration of just about everything that's still an issue percolating in the courts.
Wow. Well, you kind of teed up something else. What do you think, there's been some conversation during the presidential debates about whether or not if Vice President Biden wins, the Democrats might consider expanding the court. Do you think that's a possibility to kind of reshape that majority, minority representation on the court?
I think it's probably the first time that that idea has some currency. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of other ideas. Actually, I think Biden's idea to have a bipartisan commission study it is actually a really good one. There's a lot of different issues that you could do. For instance, you could court pack, which is such a pejorative term. What it really means is restore equal balance to the court. So you could add positions, you could subtract positions. The Supreme Court initially, when created, was 6 justices in 1789. Then it was 7, then it was 9, then it was 10, then it was 9. So we could, for instance, go back to 6. We could have mandatory retirement age, 70. We could have term limits. We could have bipartisan. You could have it like a board of election. You have to have 3 conservatives or 4 conservatives and 4 liberals. Right. I mean, the concern is that the court has become too politicized. The idea of the court and your very basic governance, you know, 3-part structure, is that the court is supposed to be it's the non-democratic branch. It's the non-elected branch. It's supposed to create the consistency of the rule of law. And we think of it as being abstract, right and wrong. That's not really true. I mean, truth is, you know, conceived through lived reality and through how you view the world and jurisprudence. So there is politicization there, but it's not meant, there's not a way to vote people out of office as we do in Congress with the executive. So now that it has become more politicized, I think it's the right time to at least think about a lot of these different issues. Now, court packing, though, I will say the concern is that, you know, each party can play that game. So Biden wins and he adds 3, and then the Republicans win next time and they add 4, and it becomes more politicized rather than less. So there may be other ways to accomplish that same goal.
I never really considered subtracting a position from the court. That's interesting. What do you think the odds are? Well, you know, you can't predict, but, you know, is there a chance really that they could undo that appointment of Amy Coney Barrett?
I don't think they would undo her appointment. They would undo the more senior they would do some kind of retirement. So, I mean, one argument, you know, the conservatives argue a lot about originalism, and the original Judiciary Act had 6. Mm-hmm. So there would be an argument to go to 6. And so you would have the 3 most senior retire. That would be 2 conservatives and 1 liberal. So that's Thomas, Breyer, and Alito. So that would usually be how you would do it rather than the newest person. But Congress can do whatever it wants. The Constitution doesn't dictate how many are on the court or if there's a retirement. That's really a congressional act. So they could change that.
What do you think they would do if they actually did create a committee to consider what would be most appropriate for the court? You know, you mentioned one thing, term limit. You know, I mean, there's nowhere else where you get appointed for life that I can think of. Would they consider actually electing them? You know, as you mentioned in your initial comment that it's not supposed to be political. However, just simply by appointment and appointment by, you know, the sitting president and the majority party confirming, you know, that kind of makes it political. But in terms of it being representative of the country, you know, I don't know that we do so well at being representative of the country in any elected office, but, you know, what would the things be that they would consider if they seated this committee?
I don't know if they would consider elections per se. We have a lot of states that elect their judges, as we do in Ohio. And so we haven't had a very good track record with that. And most of the trends are to get rid of elected state court judges, towards appointment, and those that states that have had elections stick to it. But I think that would increase the politicization of the court rather than decrease it. And that really isn't the intent or the role. And so, but I suppose that would certainly be on the table because that was certainly the state model. And so it would be up for consideration. I think really the term limits and court packing, you know, adding additional spots, positions, two positions, three, or mandating term limits are the two most serious strategies they're considering. I really like this idea more of a bipartisan. I mean, that's a long-term strategy. Mm-hmm. I can't see the Republicans ever agreeing to that. So it would really, this all turns on the Democrats having control of both chambers of the House, because really the court power has been the main Republican issue. I mean, from sort of old school mainstream Republicans in this last 4 years, this has been their key issue because so much is decided this way, and this is how you get longstanding change. So it would have to be by a Democratic controlled Congress.
Okay.
Right. So getting to the meat of some of these critical impacts, healthcare, our audience is majority of our audience is women over 50, and their number one concern, number one priority is healthcare. So what could happen with the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare that is now being considered in the court? And on what grounds could they eliminate that? Is it the individual mandate? And if so, could you explain what that is?
Yes, and the Affordable Care Act case is coming up. The case is already in the dockets. It's in early November. So the case will be before our newest justice. And so it's not that we have to wait to see very long. The issue is we have two things. One, that there's been a change in the law, and one, that we have some inclination about how Justice Barrett will rule. So in 2012, the Supreme Court already decided to, or the prior two cases, the precedent upholding the Affordable Care Act, where Justice Roberts was our swing vote, focused on the individual mandate. And the individual mandate is the requirement that individuals get health care. And that's the enforcement mechanism of the Affordable Care Act. It's an insurance program. Everybody has to buy in, whether you're sick or not, whether you're young or not, so that you can fund everybody else. And so that's really the piece of the Affordable Care Act, at least the argument is, that makes it work. So when the Supreme Court upheld that before, Justice Roberts, who was the swing vote, interpreted the individual mandate as a tax. The whole question was whether Congress had power to do this. The Constitution lays out specific powers that Congress has, and if it's not one of those powers, it can't act. The states have general welfare power. The federal government has more limited power. So the question was whether the individual mandate is enforced by what most people were calling a penalty. If you don't get insurance, you get fined, you get penalized. Well, Justice Roberts said it's a tax. And as a tax, Congress has taxing power, tax and spending power. So he found it to be viable that way. Well, in 2017, after President Trump's the last election, a new Congress, Congress passed a change where the tax on the individual mandate is zero. So there's $0 if you don't in fact fulfill the mandate, you pay $0. So the argument is that there's no longer a tax. Mm-hmm. And without the tax, the Affordable Care Act can't be justified as a tax and spending power. So now it needs some other basis, which at least last time Justice Roberts couldn't find any other basis. So that's why we have the case back again. That's why we're hearing it again. As far as Justice Coney Barrett, she wrote in a law review article, and that's what law professors write, so an academic article that she wrote when she was a law professor, criticizing Justice Roberts' approach. She said he stretched the interpretation of the statute to find it to be a tax. She didn't really say she disagreed with the ACA, but she didn't think that his textual interpretation. That's some clue that she wouldn't support that swing vote. Now the question is, does a zero tax mean that it's still a tax or is it not? So that some inclination that she would, that the basis for supporting healthcare law before is no longer there. Mm-hmm. And the votes are no longer there. Now, would they just strike down the individual mandate? Maybe. So they could retain the rest of the law and just get rid of the mandate piece. That kind of takes away the punch of the law because we can't enforce it, but we still retain everything else, like continuing coverage, coverage for dependents, mm-hmm. or they may say that it's such a key part mechanism of the whole law that the whole thing falls. So whether it can be severed or whether it's interpreted, and that remains to be seen. So we could just get a narrow ruling or we could get a very broad striking down.
So why is that a bad thing? You know, I mean, we obviously have taxes, taxes that support the entire society. Sometimes they're relevant for you, sometimes they're not. But, you know, the general purpose is to support and perform for the larger society. So whether you're talking about infrastructure, you know, roads, you know, bridges, utilities, et cetera, or if you're talking about like school system, not everyone has children. Or you have children and they grow up and you no longer have children in that school system, but you continue your property taxes, at least in Ohio. We come up with tons of examples as to how and when there are situations where we're required to pay a tax or pay to support a system that doesn't necessarily represent or serve us ever or currently. So why has that become such a big focus of it when the purpose of it is to relieve the burden on everyone?
Well, it only became part of it because Justice Roberts made it that way, right? I mean, Congress didn't conceive of it as a tax. And you're absolutely right. That's what he argued, actually, was mm-hmm. that it's a tax like any, we have so many, and that's just how it works. Mm-hmm. The catch now, though, is that the majority may no longer think of it as a tax. And if it's not a tax, there may, at least the conservative justices don't see any other authority in the Constitution to make it a tax. As to, you know, whether that's fair and equitable to be paying taxes, I mean, that's a little bit of, I mean, that's the policy difference between Republican and Democrats, whether, you know, libertarian views or communitarian views. So the view in general, but that's sort of Justice Coney Barrett's criticism, right? This is just not a tax. It's a penalty. And it's a mandate. It requires healthcare and it requires people to do it just like they require you, you know, to follow the law, drive on the right side of the street. And if you don't, you can get arrested. So it's a penalty. It's not a tax, but we don't have a basis for doing that kind of enactments.
Okay. Now, one of the senators, I believe, during the confirmation hearings asked her if she would recuse herself from a vote on the ACA, and she refused to, you know, give a solid answer to that. But on what grounds could she recuse?
I don't see that the recusal really happening in the Affordable Care Act context. I mean, recusing is, especially at the Supreme Court level, is pretty rare. It's usually for something if there is a direct financial or personal interest in the case. And so sometimes we've seen justices recuse for sometimes like if they hold stock. So it's a case about Exxon and you hold Exxon stock.
Right, like a conflict of interest.
Right. So a really specific. I'm not sure why the question would have been asked with respect to the Affordable Care Act. I mean, she has been on record as some of her sort of an opinion. I mean, that's not really an opinion on the merits. It's an opinion on interpretation. She does, though, in other contexts. She has a law review article she wrote about judges in general recusing themselves when they hit issues of what the religion Catholic judges would say are immoral. So she has, that was in the context of the death penalty, though. So I'm not sure if they were trying to connect those two, right? But she wrote in this, it's a very old law review article, but she is Catholic and she was engaging with the question of if a judge were Catholic, should faith govern the role of the judicial role? And her conclusion along with her co-author was that the killing and the death penalty is always immoral, and so that a Catholic judge could be a part of that, so they should recuse themselves from that decision. Now, they kind of split the difference. They said, a Catholic judge should not be the trial judge imposing the death penalty or sentencing, but it would be okay if maybe if you were a reviewing judge, And so as she's been on the Seventh Circuit reviewing habeas petitions or requests to reconsider death penalty, she has reviewed those. She has not recused in those contexts. But, you know, so she, but at least she is somewhere has been thinking about, instead of voting against something you think is immoral, you should maybe recuse. And maybe that's where it's coming from. But I don't see that she has a personal or a financial interest per se in the healthcare issue that would require a recusal.
So we know that the ACA, as you said, is coming up before the court in November, and new Justice Barrett will certainly have an opportunity to weigh in on that. But going forward, some of the other things that we talked about, reproductive rights, LGBTQIA rights, gun control, affirmative action, immigrant protections, some of the things that are really, that continue to be hot buttons and recurring conversations. How does that get teed up? So we know that the ACA is already about to come before the court. So things are funneled up through lower courts up there. You don't ever go right straight to the Supreme Court. But explain for our audience, what is the process? What are the avenues that can lead a case or an issue to come before the court for reconsideration?
Yes, so there's really two ways, and they usually take quite a bit of time. So one way is through the federal courts, and so there's a district level appellate and then the Supreme Court. So there would be two courts hearing it before it gets to the Supreme Court. And that's on question federal questions normally, or between citizens of different states. Something can also get to the U.S. Supreme Court coming through the state system. So then it goes to like the Ohio trial court, the Ohio appellate court, the Ohio Supreme Court, and then the U.S. Supreme Court, again, if there is a federal constitutional question. So that takes four steps. Now, so often we say, you know, I mean, that could take 3 years, 4 years, 2 years, but a lengthy period of time. Our normal judicial process is to let the lower judges work out the facts, work out the law, let the parties, let another court reconsider it, you know, before we have to have an absolute decision. But what you are seeing, or you may be seeing in these last weeks, are talking about the shadow docket. There have been a variety of cases that are coming immediately to the Supreme Court about extending election deadlines, absentee ballot deadlines, numbers of drop boxes. The court, if there is a lower court decision in the federal courts and it's some kind of quote emergency, they petition the U.S. Supreme Court to, whether to stay the action, whether they freeze the action, whether we issue the injunction, because there's some immediacy. We don't have time to wait 2 years to appeal the full issue of whether we should allow an extension of the absentee deadline. We need to know right now. And so the court simply there has to vote, and we don't get decisions. So we are seeing this new shadow docket, which is happening in a matter of weeks and days, mm-hmm. and without decision. I mean, some of those decisions, we see a vote, and then we see one or two justices dissenting. So we may get a criticism, but we're not seeing their full view. And that's concerning to a lot of legal scholars because we're not getting the full vetting of the issue. We're not even getting the full benefit of seeing what their thinking is or why they're, you know, usually you have to substantiate your vote by joining one of the opinions. So there are some of these things, COVID issues, staying open the church, as well as election issues that are starting to be taken in a matter of weeks and days.
Well, you teed that up. That's a great segue. So we're looking at possibly a longer determination just because of the number of people that have voted, the number of people that have voted by mail, you know, and contrary to popular belief, everything does get counted, provisionals, the whole nine yards. So that has to happen for the boards of election to certify the election results. So understanding that, at what point could there be a request for intervention from the Supreme Court in a decision? And what's the actual requirement before the court would get involved in that? Because the only other time that I recall that happening was in former President George Bush's reelection campaign.
I mean, we have a good precedent in Bush versus Gore, and the precedent before that was sort of the late 19th century. So at least a closely analogous case. I mean, it should be a short time. It would be a week, it would be 2 weeks, it would be 3 weeks. In the Bush versus Gore case, there was the allegation that when Florida was recounting its ballots back to the days of Chads and punch bowl voting, that it wasn't counting them fairly, right? But it still went through the state courts. So there was an issue in Florida, the Florida state courts heard it first. Then there was a claim that it was a constitutional violation, equal protection, treating voters unequally based on your county. And so that went to the Supreme Court. I don't remember the exact days, 10 days, 2 weeks, you know, a couple of weeks, because there was this constitutional deadline about when, if we don't get an election, how does Congress then step in, or that, like, you know, the process has to kick in. So we knew there was a deadline. But if there is, that's another example where the court will act very quickly, depending on the petition, and to protect the rights and make the decision. So that could very well be happening.
Interesting. So what other cases do you anticipate that could possibly become a part of this shadow docket, you know, and get teed up really quickly, you know, especially some of those that we've been talking about that are on that contentious list that have always remained, even post-decision, remained part of the public discourse here?
Well, it's not really supposed to be many, but for example, we saw in the recent Equal Rights Amendment case, we saw the parties try to take advantage of the shadow docket, and the court said, no, you got to go through the regular process. So that was a case, there are three cases pending on the Equal Rights Amendment challenge, saying actually two on one side, one on the other, but we've had arguably the number of states ratify the ERA that needed to. And now the question is, do we certify that or not, or did they exceed the deadline originally established by Congress? And so one of those cases, just U.S. District Court said the plaintiffs didn't have standing. Women in general don't have the kind of particularized injury that you need to bring a lawsuit. You have a generalized interest. Yeah, if you just have a general interest in a law, you're supposed to use the democratic process. And so, for instance, if you are part of the Sierra Club and want to save the environment, you cannot just petition to challenge a law about the environment. You have to use the legislative democratic process. So, yes, but the irony that, of course, is the ERA is about, right, women's equality. And so, do not to petition. So, but they lost in the district court, and they tried to go straight to the Supreme Court using different procedures, using this, and the Supreme Court said, no, you need to go to the appellate court first. There's not an immediate timing. So usually the quickness is if there's some deadline, right? Like the election is in 4 days, we need to decide if the drop box has to be open, or otherwise the court is very much wants to use the usual process.
We did just have that issue with whether or not they would count mail-in ballots up to 3 days after the election in Pennsylvania. And Amy Coney Barrett did recuse herself from that. And the court did decide that those ballots could be counted.
Well, there have been like three in the last 2 days. And I'm not sure if Amy Coney Barrett recused herself or she just hasn't really begun hearing the cases yet.
Because they're happening. She did. She said she didn't have time to review the documents.
Right. But that's different than a recusal that says I have a conflict of interest.
Oh, okay.
This is I'm not really on the job yet, and it's happening so fast, I'm not able to do it, you know, full justice. So you're right. So she didn't hear it, but it's a slightly different procedural posture.
I see. Okay. After a quick 30-second break, we're going to talk about the real impacts this change in the Supreme Court could have on Roe v. Wade and gay marriage and other LGBTQ issues and more. Okay, we're back. So again, we have Professor Tracy Thomas with us, and she's an expert on constitutional law. I want to bring up something that one of our listeners brought up on our Facebook page. We all know there's been a lot of criticism to begin with the appointment of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court, just with the President, the House, and the Senate Republicans pushing this appointment through for two reasons. Because of the timing, right before the presidential election, when leadership could change imminently, and the other was because of the amount of time Congress spent on this nomination, shifting their focus from working on a stimulus relief package for the millions of Americans in crisis, losing their businesses, losing their jobs, their health care, their homes, to spending three long days in confirmation hearings and more with preparation, of course, to push this nomination through in order to hold on to a majority in the Supreme Court. And it's done now. She's in. she's been confirmed, but will this idea that whomever holds the reins at the top will continue to have the power to make such a decision?
Who will consider that, actually? Would that be the potential committee that we talked about that might look at how the Supreme Court should be managed, or would that be a congressional decision?
It could be part of the commission, and it could be something that Congress would consider, although I really don't think that's likely. Really, this nomination process was not that unusual if you look at the big historical picture. If you go back to the beginning, so the late 1700s, about 33% of all Supreme Court justices have been nominated in this very short window of time prior to an election. And even about half of those have been in lame duck sessions. So after the president loses in the November election, but before the transition in January. So where there clearly is not a public mandate, but because that's sort of the right, you're still the acting president. And so we haven't had as many recent, most of these, I think the last one was in the late 19th century, but it happened quite a bit. So it wasn't that unusual, and it was part of what the, you know, the governing president gets to do. Your party wins, and that is a right of that president. As to the rules, what really changed the game was getting rid of the filibuster of Supreme Court nominees, which was with the Merrick Garland and the Mitch McConnell's maneuver to get rid of a procedural rule. And that was just a rule of the internal governance of how Congress conducts itself in its procedures and having these hearings. But the inability to challenge or delay or use that classic, very old process allowed the opposing party to block a sitting president's nominee. Mm-hmm. And so that was the big game changer. So Congress could restore the procedures, right? It could go back to that. But all of that is really part of the regular process of how Congress works and who's in charge. So if you want it to be different, you have to elect the members of Congress, specifically the Senate, who you want, you know, to articulate your view. You know, as to whether this was time better spent, they should have been, I mean, we are in obviously unprecedented times. Again, the way you respond to that is you vote those people out of office, right? This was your priority. That's not my priority. You don't represent me, so I won't reelect you. So that's meant to be the mechanism for that.
Right, right. One of the other things that was a pushback, not just in the time frame that this actually, the decision was made, but also there were some rumblings about her qualifications. And I heard this in a couple of news stories, not a lot, but I thought it was important because I don't know that we have, and if we do, what the standard is, what the qualifications are to be appointed to the Supreme Court, because the conversation around Justice Barrett was that, you know, she had a very quick ascent from the classroom to the Supreme Court bench, not a lot of time on the bench anywhere before this ascent. Is that fair? And what is there any typical expectation around qualifications?
I actually don't think that's a fair criticism, to be quite honest. I've heard it as well. I mean, there are no qualification standards per se. Okay. Over the only thing we know about Supreme Court justices, again, the long view, is that they've been attorneys. And in different periods of time, again, back to the 19th century, there are much more political appointments, people's donors, friends, nepotism, not really much actual credentials. In modern times, we have had the American Bar Association start to weigh in on evaluating credentials. But I think she satisfies all those. I mean, she does. I mean, being a law professor is actually a pretty good credential. We've had other justices. That means you've been thinking deeply about the court and the law, not just, you know, trying to get your client's business interests advanced, which is what attorneys do. And she was on the Federal Circuit Court for 3 years. So, and she had private practice before that. She clerked for Justice Scalia. That's one of the highest accolades that an attorney can get in training. So she's definitely qualified. You may not agree with her positions or her jurisprudence or her politics, but she has the qualification. I mean, we saw this a little bit back in George W. Bush's appointments.
Some of them saying, well, you know, that the some of the people on the short list were just attorneys who hadn't been judges at all. Mm-hmm. We had the same criticism of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor when she was first nominated, that she had been a state court judge and not a federal court. So what did she know about that? But I think all of those qualifications are relevant. And all of them are good. And I think she's qualified to be a justice.
Just of note, she just happens to be the only Supreme Court justice who did not attend Harvard or Yale Law School. She went to Rhodes College, a liberal arts school in Memphis, Tennessee, and for undergrad, and law school in Indiana at Notre Dame.
Although Notre Dame is still one of the top ranked law schools, so we're not too different there. I mean, there is a movement to say that the justices should be much more diverse educationally, as many other kinds of diversity.
That makes sense.
But that they're not really, having them all be from Harvard and Yale is not really representative. And so she does change that balance.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. Another issue, pretty important to women, would be abortion. Roe v. Wade, could it be overturned? Right now, according to the Guttmacher Institute, which is really one of the greatest authorities on abortion statistics, 75% of the U.S. population is in favor of choice. So is it really, you know, likely that that could be overturned?
I think absolutely it's going to be overturned. I don't think there's a question.
Wow.
Roe has already been about as close to being overturned already. And that is clearly a strong view that this justice has. The fact about the Democratic, 75% public support is not really supposed to be relevant to the Supreme Court. But I'll come back to that. It may be relevant to Justice Coney Barrett, but I'll show it in a minute. I mean, the question is, for the court, does the Constitution protect that right? And there is a disagreement. And so far, right, we haven't had five justices disagreeing with the precedent. Roe versus Wade said it's in the 14th Amendment protects liberty. And liberty, they said, includes privacy, but the word privacy is not there. And privacy includes bodily autonomy and choice. And that's how we get the right to choose. And so we don't just have Justice Coney Barrett. We also have Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch weighing in now. So I don't see any of them supporting sustaining Roe. And so even Justice Roberts, who was our swing vote the last time we had an abortion case recently, reconsidering the question of admitting privileges for abortion providers. And he stuck to the precedent. In June Medical Services, he stuck to the precedent of Whole Woman's Health. But again, it doesn't matter. He's no longer the swing vote. So I think we know that Justice Coney Barrett has already been on record. Two cases in the Seventh Circuit where she has joined dissents, specifically that would have invalidated or wanted to take the case to invalidate. Posture's a little different, but would have ultimately endorsed the elimination of the right to abortion in those specific states. So it's not really necessarily just her personal view. I mean, she gave the answer in her confirmation that regardless of her personal views, that's not what she was there. That's not what the job was asking her. But we see her judicial views. We can see that she believes that abortion is immoral in every case. And we see her judicial reasoning saying that those state laws banning abortion in various contexts should be upheld. And so we've had Roe versus Wade, the legal standard of Roe versus Wade has already been changed. We changed that in Pennsylvania versus Casey, which was 25 years after Roe. So we already said that even though there's this constitutional right of choice, the government can burden that right. And we don't say that with any other fundamental right. So we said the government can regulate this particular fundamental right more than all the other ones we have. It just can't unduly burden. So as of Casey, we already opened up the avenue to have all of these state regulations, waiting periods, doctor's privileges,
parental notification,
parental notification, minors. It's really these delayed, that these waiting periods, and these you need to come back in 3 days, 4 days to take the medication. You have to come into a clinic. It's really the traveling. Many states only have one clinic or none. And so, so those have already been in place for a while. So we've already been seeing the elimination of Roe, and now we're at this very tenuous balance. And again, the two newest justices have articulated they don't see that the Constitution protects that specific liberty interest. And we have a track record with Justice Coney Barrett. So I think absolutely it's going to be changed. Which case will do it? Is it one of the cases currently in the pipeline? Do we need to wait for the strategies change? Mm-hmm. For the pro-life movement now, because now they have a more receptive audience. So they may, you know, the cases coming up were maybe more tailored to Justice Roberts, sort of the smaller cases, rather than, for instance, the heartbeat bill or a complete ban. So those cases we expect will be seen. And so whether that is a year or two, you know, we may have some time to get the right case, but I think it's for sure going to happen.
Wow.
How do states play into this in terms of the varying positions that states have around abortion access, you know, parental permission, the number of bills that continue to come up challenging everything from access to age limit to all of that? So what is the balance there between whatever could potentially happen at the Supreme Court level and what continues to happen within the states across the country?
Well, if we overrule Roe, then the state laws that are there immediately go into effect. And Mary Ziegler is kind of the leading legal scholar on this. She says there are 21 states who would automatically essentially ban abortion or make it, I mean, some of the rules we have right now, we have 6 weeks, you know, no abortion after 6 weeks, or a really lit or heartbeat bill. That's same kind of idea. So those are pretty narrow. So those would immediately go into effect. So 21 states, there's only about maybe three states that have actually enacted more expansive. So New York, for example, recently passed legislation to expand and protect pro-choice. So that would happen immediately. And then we would see each state trying to navigate whether it wanted to be sort of pro-choice or whether it would be going on more bans. We might see a federal law. And what's predicted, though, is that that's not really the end of the pro-life movement. If we, for instance, were to get a Democratic Congress in both chambers and would get a woman's autonomy right in legislation, because that Roe just says it's not in the Constitution. So that's what the Supreme Court would be doing. So Congress could always protect that choice. But the next strategy of the pro-life movement is for a human life amendment, or a recognizing that the Constitution's liberty protects human life beginning from the point of conception. Mm-hmm. And if that's true, then that would invalidate federal legislation. Mm-hmm. So there's a very, you know, there's many, many steps of, so if you wanted to protect pro-choice rights, you would need to first go state by state. The easiest thing would be to try to get a federal law, but we need the Senate. So mainly, I mean, you also need the presidency to secure, but if you can't overcome veto, then it's enough to have Congress, obviously. Yeah. So there's more that can happen, but we wouldn't expect the Supreme Court to really be the one protecting this right much longer.
Hmm. Where do you see, what about gay marriage? Is that at risk?
I think so. Again, we have some clues from Amy Coney Barrett, who believes, we saw just recently in early October, Justice Thomas wrote a dissent, procedural dissent again, not taking a case, but signaling that he continued to think Obergefell was decided wrong, and that Obergefell is the case that recognized same-sex marriage.
Okay.
And that it came out of Ohio. And Obergefell, that the Supreme Court enacted same-sex marriage through its own decision so it could retract it. So we have justice on the record of signaling that he would like to reconsider that. And we have Amy Coney Barrett, and some, you know, we're all looking through the clues and trying to read the tea leaves, but we see not just her personal views again, but some judicial views suggesting that she thinks that there again is not constitutional requirement of that, and that she would join those dissenting justices in reconsidering Obergefell.
You know, what does that mean for those marriages then? Are they grandfathered?
Wow, that's a good question.
Illegal, or are they all dissolved? You know, how does that work retroactively?
Usually we do not impose decisions retroactively. So then of course you would have this anomaly where you'd have this period of time where those marriages would be valid and would be sort of
like maybe a grandfather clause.
Yeah, we say grandfathering them in. I mean, wow. I don't know that, I mean, we haven't really had a retraction of civil rights in that same way. We've had usually, you know, we've had separate but equal overturned, so then the separate but equal was no longer valid. So it would certainly be quite, I mean, the normal way we evaluate the validity of marriage is, did it comply with the law at the time it was celebrated? So those existing marriages should continue on as being valid. Of course, that doesn't, you know, change the fact that you could not get married going forward.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah, there's sounds like there really is a lot that could be impacted and affecting a whole lot of people. Another one regarding LGBTQ issues, Title VII workplace discrimination. I think we talked about in the pre-interview, Bostock versus Clayton County and Altitude Express Inc. versus Zarda set a precedent for future decisions, decided 6-3 in a ruling, including conservatives in favor. I probably messed that all up, but what is Amy Coney Barrett's, like you said, you weren't sure maybe about her history with regard to LGBTQ rights, but what can you say to that?
That's one decision that might stick. So in that case, we did see the conservatives, namely Gorsuch, coming out, and the question was, under Title VII, which prohibits gender discrimination in employment, does gender include specifically gay and or transgender? So that those conservative justices subscribe to the view called textualism, which is that you read in the plain meaning of the text as it meant at the time, and using a very basic textual analogy said that includes, again, the plaintiff specifically gay and then transgender. And so Amy Coney Barrett is, she's an originalist and in many cases also a textualist. Originalism is we interpret the Constitution based on the original meaning and public understanding at the time. Title VII is not a constitution, it's a statute that was passed in the civil rights time. So textualism is we look at the text, the plain language, what do these words on the face mean? So even if she changed, I think we still have a majority in support of that. And that's where you see, Gorsuch is one who really subscribes to this textualism and interpretism. So that's where you see his kind of libertarian views coming out and see him sort of adhering to his view of how you read statutes more than the policy decision per se. So I wouldn't necessarily see a change in that. The question is whether that Title VII ruling, whether the court would extend it to the Constitution. Under the current Constitution, the court has never resolved whether discrimination based on a sexual orientation is given heightened scrutiny or whether it's just like routine legislation. And so we've had some cases that have suggested it's more like race or sex discrimination, but this ruling suggested maybe they would read the Constitution to protect against sexual orientation discrimination, even though the reasoning doesn't support it, right? I mean, the text and the Constitution, when we got the 14th Amendment after the Civil War, probably didn't envision including transgender folks.
Probably not.
It didn't really even include gender. It included textually, it included race, right?
Right. Another question, as the mother of a son in the military, I know that, my son is serving in the U.S. Navy active duty, and there are gay men even that he works with. What about gays in the military? Could that be impacted? That decision be overturned?
Well, it could be because a lot,
some of those decisions really depend on executive orders, so that as the president changes, the president can issue different executive orders allowing or determining, and then we challenge them. So some of how we've gotten those decisions came up a little bit differently. Executive orders is a power that President Obama really learned to utilize, but it's very temporary. It's only as good as your term limit. So President Trump has done the same thing. So we have different rules coming out of the Department of Education for campus sexual assault. We have different Clean Air Act, rules, but they only last the term of the presidency. Mm. So,
well, again, with regard to Amy Coney Barrett, this is a big question, as to whether or not she can remain objective or neutral, considering how quote unquote she, religious she seems to be. I mean, even recently the Pope, said that he accepted gay people and civil unions into the church, but she is more of a, while she's Catholic, belongs to, what is the group called? I have my notes here.
People of Praise, I think.
Yes. Mm-hmm. People of Praise. Also was a member of University Faculty for Life, which is a pro-life group. And, again, went to Notre Dame, a Catholic university, taught at Notre Dame, a Catholic university, for 15 years. So it'll be interesting to see.
But, there was a lot of pushback on that, too, because there was a question, I think this even came up during the Senate hearings, about the relevance of her faith. I don't know this for fact, but I would wager that probably all of the sitting justices are people of faith to some extent. It's just not come up and didn't come up in their consideration, especially, there's always a different dynamic when the candidate is female on so many different levels. And not just that of faith, but, we seem to get a harder interrogation than the guys do just across the board. But I don't think you can separate people from their faith. And I think the fact that there's been such a huge focus on that, I don't believe it's real to say that I would not consider my faith, because it shapes you and it shapes your values, et cetera, which is why conservatives want conservative justices and liberals want liberal justices, because there's going to be a leaning in a certain direction based on your understanding of their values. And values, are generally influenced by a person's faith.
The faith is very extreme, and you're talking about a person who is considering, for example, that abortion is murder, and if they vote in favor of pro-choice, they think they're going to hell. I mean, they think they're committing a mortal sin. Mm-hmm. So to me, can that person be objective?
Can it just be objective?
Hmm?
I said, can an atheist be objective? I think it's the same thing. That perspective is shaping that individual to the same extent, I think, that a person of faith's religion is impacting them, or just your family values or whatever. I don't think you really ever separate from that. Professor, you were going to say something?
Well, I think there's been this eternal battle between how do judges judge? I mean, it goes back to our earliest philosophers, right? Is there an objective truth? Is there really a positive truth that we can all look at and find, the right and wrong answers? Or is it all just judicial activism, that as a judge, you can do what you want and get the result that you want, using the law as a means to that? And then there's everything in the middle. But I think we've seen over the last two decades that judges do judge based on their own rose-colored lenses, right? There's only one way you can look at the world, and your experiences shape you. Justice Sotomayor has said this, right? I am a wise Latina woman. That's just sort of how I see the world. Now, that's different, though, than in the article I mentioned before, where Amy Coney Barrett wrote about what's the role of Catholic judges. I mean, hers is a little different because she has gone on the record as talking about that faith should inform your judging, although her accommodation was, again, to recuse, mm-hmm. because there's also a respect, she said, for the rule of law, that knowing that I know that this is my faith and this is in church, but here is the court and the rule of law. And so there's a balance. And so how do I reconcile? There again, it was, you know, I recuse instead of voting against the death penalty. But I think, you know, the legal realism movement that came around in the early 1900s, you know, said, look, judges' decisions do have reality. These are not abstract principles of gravity or science, right? They are truths that are depend on how you see the world. Now, that doesn't mean you can make it be anything you want, right? There's a spectrum, and there's some room in the middle that differs based on, you know, how you view philosophically the law, philosophically the roles of the courts, what belongs in the court, what belongs in the church, what belongs in the home. But then there's also a lot of outlier issues. So, but I think most of us have, and legal scholars have come to realize that yes, who you are does inform what you're doing. Now, some judges are more about making sure that they will put that to the side, but that's what we won't know.
Okay, I've got one last question for you. And this, I just kind of wanted to leave it open for you to address anything that you, that we, didn't have the forethought or understanding to ask you, but, you know, what should we be thinking about and considering as we have discussions around the Supreme Court? And what is it that we should be concerned about? But what is it, just, you know, as a nation, what's important?
Yeah, what do we miss?
Well, I think the one interesting issue that's really coming up is what role should the court be playing? Should they be playing this outsized political role? My college-age kids are sort of saying, how can the court not be responsive to us? How can they, the questions we've been asking, but it's really asking us to reconsider what is this whole role of this whole third part of our governance system? And the way to really make it accountable, again, is through electing your Congress representatives, right? Because that's where the power to change the court really comes from. And I think that engagement with the court and understanding it is pretty new. And that's encouraging to me because it means that people, especially the newer generations, are taking account of how big decisions are made and how to be a part of that rather than kind of a bystander.
Gotcha. Well, Professor Thomas, you have been a most excellent guest and made very difficult information and considerations around the court really easy for us to talk about and to understand. So we thank you for that, because I think our listeners, you know, these are really important things that often we shy away from because we really don't have, you know, the understanding to really be able to converse about them. But I think you really did a great job for us in explaining all of the issues and questions and concerns that we had today. And we might invite you back after this election. And again, we're not sure when our listeners are listening.
You're reading my mind, Tracy.
Yeah, there might be some constitutional questions that come up post-election, you know, depending on which way it goes, and with this just being such an exceptional time. So thank you again so much. You really have been a wonderful guest. And Di, I'm going to turn over to you to let people know how to follow us and connect with us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Professor Thomas. That was wonderful. And we want to thank all of our audience members for listening. Once again, we are Women with Issues. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/womenwithissuespodcast. We are on Instagram and Twitter as Women with Issues. And we would love to hear from you. We would love your feedback on this episode. We'd like to know what you want to hear next. And we're trying to decide, you know, our direction post-election, since that's what we've been focusing on for the last 9 months. And we want to thank our technical producer, Cade Hessman. Yay, Cade. We are Women with Issues.
Thanks for listening. We're talking to you.
Bye-bye.